memory shot. It, you know, even for me, it was tough slogging at some points. And I thought, you know, if I'm at times struggling with this, imagine what the average person is going through. So, you know, I'm very much a, you know, when life hands you lemons, make lemonade, although, you know, throw a bit of vodka in it. But, you know, it's so I really tried to take a lousy situation and say, well, you know, how can I use my science background to help other people? Because this is just it was such a shock to know that, you know, those of us in chronic Lyme have no support from our publicly funded healthcare system. And you really do have to just educate yourself, learn and be a very vocal advocate for yourself. And I thought, well, I have the skill to do that because of my science background, but what about people who don't? And then the other part of it, so that's why I wrote the book. And when I discussed it with Firefly Books, I said, I don't want to recreate what's already out there. I want a primer. I basically want to give people, what are the absolute fundamentals that you need to know to help yourself? And then for all the other details, you know, go to those other great books that are out there. But this is kind of, I wanted to write almost like a starting point, like a quick reference guide. And then the other part of that was, you know, as many, if not most of us with Lyme disease and other tick-borne illnesses go through, it's other Lyme sufferers or, you know, those close to Lyme sufferers that become your biggest support and your biggest help. And I've had massive support from, you know, a lot of people. And for me, the book is kind of a way to pay it forward.
Oh, that's amazing. I know this next question is the right question for you because you studied evolutionary ecology and population genetics. I'm sort of going back to my university science classes and I saw this section on the taxonomy of Borrelia. And I thought, wow, this is a great question for you because, you know, when I read through that, you speak about the fact that there's 52 different species of Borrelia. And then you also speak about strains and genetic diversity. And I can see that you've also linked it to, you know, understanding why testing is not accurate yet for Lyme testing. So
exactly. And I think this is such an important part of the story and one that doesn't get, you know, perhaps as much attention as it should be. And especially with testing in Canada and probably the US as well. But obviously, you know, I'm most familiar with our system here in Canada, but yeah, you know, like if we're using tests to detect certain species, you know, are we missing things? And we know that between, you know, the movement of migratory birds and just human travel, you know, people traveling to, you know, to other countries and potentially getting Lyme there and then coming back home and testing negative because it was a different strain or different species of, you know, of Lyme disease. You know, a lot of it obviously depends on the kind of test that you use, but you know, we test for, you know, basically one species and what one strain here. And, you know, I don't think science has the full understanding of the genetic diversity at, either at the species level or the strain level, you know, for Borrelia. And, you know, how do we develop the best tools to detect these infections when, you know, we're not even sure about the genetic diversity out there. And so thank goodness, you know, there's science happening that's looking into this, but you know, there's obviously still more for us to learn.
Absolutely. Now, I've looked at your bibliography, which is just rich with peer-reviewed scientific articles. So for those people who are really looking for the hard science on this, I highly recommend going there. Do you have any favorite peer-reviewed scientific articles that you referenced in your book?
Ooh, that's a tough one. Gosh, I, you know, without kind of like referring to like, you know, specific, you know, sort of specific papers and names and dates and that sort of thing, because as you know, those of us with Lyme brain, you know, our short-term memory is shot, right? But I think some of the papers that perhaps were the most important to me, certainly there was a paper that was a meta-analysis of the efficacy of the two-tier testing. That showed that, you know, the two-tier testing that we use here in Canada, for example, you know, if you have Lyme disease, the probability that those tests, those two-tier tests will detect it is 54% on average. And that's based on a meta-analysis of, can't remember if it was something like 17 different peer-reviewed research papers. And I think, you know, it's science runs on consensus, right? We you know, we come up with observations, we ask questions, we test them, we collect data, and, you know, we're constantly sort of revising our knowledge and our perspective. And, you know, I think when enough of a body of scientific peer-reviewed literature is accumulated that we can then do a meta-analysis, I think those are really important because it kind of gives us a sense of, well, what overall are we finding? And when you find that the tests that, you know, we're using to detect Lyme disease, you might, it, you know, it's almost equivalent to a coin toss, right? You know, part of it has to do with in which phase, you know, what stage do you test Lyme? Because the efficacy of those tests, you know, does vary sort of over the different phases. But, you know, I think it just sort of underpins a really important message, which is that, you know, these antibody tests were never designed as diagnostic tests. They were surveillance tests. And so, you know, the fact that doctors rely on them far, far too much, you know, we should be relying on a clinical diagnosis. And there's that 2012 bulletin from Public Health Agency of Canada or Health Canada that is advice to doctors that says, you know, and this is back in 2012, that says, you know, especially the first test, the ELISA, is really insensitive and don't rely on it. Use it as a support tool, but your diagnosis should be clinical. And yet, you know, far too many of us are experiencing the opposite where, you know, I've never had a bullseye rash and I've been bitten a number of times. And actually out of the number of times I've been bitten, I've only ever had one rash, which I thought was a spider bite because it was a solid red oval. And, you know, and then I also recently read a paper, you know, that looked at the incidence of that bullseye rash in folks, and it was found to be about 9%. So when doctors in public health say, you know, look for the bullseye, had I known that a solid red rash was not necessarily a spider bite, I could have saved myself a whole lot of grief.
Yeah, well, you bring up so many great points there. So I'm going to just reinforce something we've talked about on our podcast before. So for one thing, you are a board member at CanLyme, and thank you so much for your service. We really appreciate it. But CanLyme is offering grants to physicians who do want to get more training in Lyme disease and other tick-borne illnesses. So we do have grants available to do the fundamentals course through the International Lyme and Associated Diseases Society. And we have that information on our Looking at Lyme website. But it really is so important to understand how to do a clinical diagnosis. And Dr. Betty Maloney has talked about that on our podcast as well. And really just talks about the importance of, you can't rule Lyme disease out with our current testing. So it always has to stay on the differential diagnosis for patients.
Absolutely. And I think that's such an important message for our medical doctors, for our physicians to understand. And as we know, unfortunately, you know, doctors aren't receiving what I would consider adequate training in med school about how to diagnose and treat Lyme disease. So I think we really need to go down to, you know, sort of basics and say, well, what are we teaching our doctors in training? And, you know, I think, you know, one of the biggest frustrations for me is that, you know, the body of peer-reviewed science for Lyme and tick-borne diseases has, I mean, literally exploded in recent years. And yet the way that our medical, you know, profession in Canada, and I think in general in North America, treats Lyme diseases, they basically ignore all of that science. You know, we just look at the IDSA guidelines and they don't reflect the current peer-reviewed science. And so, you know, I think we really need to force the issue to say, look, it's time to play catch-up. It's time to utilize the current information so that we keep people safe, because a lot of the information that doctors and public health will tell you, unfortunately, lead to a lack of a diagnosis, which means that critical window for treatment right after a bite is missed.
Absolutely. And, you know, I think it's all part of this advocating that you speak about in your book as well. And I think if people have good relationships with their doctors, you know, you can advocate for yourself and ask them to go do this training. The training doesn't take long. It's all offered virtually now because of, you know, COVID and everyone having to pivot. But, you know, you can ask your doctor to go and get more training. There's nothing wrong with taking that approach as well as part of your advocating for yourself.
Absolutely. And, you know, I think that's absolutely fantastic advice. And I think, you know, it's unfortunate that, you know, those of us with Lyme, and especially chronic Lyme, which isn't actually recognized as a real disease, you know, by our medical profession in Canada, you know, sometimes it means that our relationship with our healthcare providers is adversarial. I don't like that, and I don't think it's the most productive way to proceed, but unfortunately, sometimes that happens. But having a great relationship, especially, you know, with your family physician, your GP, is important. And I think, you know, in all due respect, I think we need to be willing to challenge them in a constructive and a respectful way, but to say, you know, I'm not so sure about this and I want you to do some more digging. You know, we're, as patients, we're not just at a doctor's mercy. It really should be a collaboration, right? And I personally think that's true of any medical care that we get. I'm not saying that I'm an expert and I'm certainly not a medical doctor, but, you know, if I hear something that just kind of doesn't sit right with me, it doesn't sound like common sense, I'm willing to ask questions about it. And I think we all should be.
Definitely. And I mean, there's nothing wrong with getting another opinion. And, you know, in my case, and I think in your case too, I ended up going to the States and, you know, paying for somebody to care for me and give me another opinion. And it was such a relief to finally see a doctor that knew anything about Lyme disease.
Isn't that wild? It's actually amazing, kind of that the sense of relief and almost kind of validation that you feel, because, you know, so often you're told, oh, it's all in your head. Or, you know, I end up going to a private clinic in Ontario. I was ready to go to the US, but was lucky enough to get into this other clinic. And you know, what's great is that my, you know, I have a medical team that looks after me, but the medical doctor, the MD who leads that team and who takes care of me, you know, we have conversations on the phone, you know, when I have appointments and things, and I can ask him any question and I can say to him, well, I'm not so sure about this, so explain it to me. Or I can say, well, you know, I also have this other symptom. And so, you know, I'm thinking maybe the babesia hasn't gone away. And he says, okay, well, let's chat about it. And then, you know, and then it helps him do his job, right?
Right. And you're engaged with curiosity instead of just being shut down.
Exactly.
Yeah. And in Ontario, there is a new program that was just launched this year called TICMD, which is a virtual healthcare project or program. And so that's just launched as well. So it's nice that there's that opportunity for people in Ontario now too.
I think that's fabulous. I think we need more of these kinds of tools to help people. And, I just, every time I see a program like that, or as you say, like the doctor training program, I think those are huge positive steps forward.
So quickly, I just want to go back to your book. You had a really great chapter on how to check for ticks, and you talked about specifically looking for ticks on your children and on your pets. Do you have any tips for our listeners?
Develop new habits. Do this daily. I mean, I basically do it from essentially the beginning of March until December. You know, I live in Eastern Ontario near Westport, so between Ottawa and Kingston, and I live in a hot spot. You know, there's an area not too far from me where some sampling was done, and it was by University of Guelph, and they found that 80% of the ticks sampled were Lyme positive. So, and my backyard for the past 6 years has been just crawling with ticks. And I've had to, you know, sort of tweak my lifestyle and adopt new habits. I think one thing that's really important is, you know, for the friends who have kind of watched me go through this Lyme journey and frankly have seen me suffer dearly, some of them have said, there's no way I'm going outside again. And my response to them is, that's not helpful. You know, we know that there are physical and mental health benefits of spending time in nature. And, you know, and I'm a biologist and an environmental educator, and my entire goal is to connect people to nature and to inspire them to care about it and protect it. And if we're, if we feel chased indoors by ticks, that's not going to help. So my alternative, you know, I'm very solutions oriented. And so I say to folks, well, how about just adopting some simple things that we can do? So, you know, spraying yourself with, you know, with a repellent. And so, you know, I'm a sort of heavy user of Icaridin. You know, we know that DEET's not very effective against ticks. It doesn't last that long. And the keratin, you know, lasts longer, you know, up to 12 hours. It's safer, you know, doesn't dissolve, you know, the strap on your plastic strap on your binoculars. You know, I'm constantly in my backyard. You know, I live in beautiful Canadian Shield country. And so I'm outdoors, you know, every day. And as soon as I come in, I do a tick check. And then I do a tick check again at bedtime, just in case I missed anything when I came in. And then I tell people, I actually do a tick check in the morning. And they go, well, why? You were asleep. You weren't outside. And my kind of philosophy or my thinking there is, you know, some of these, especially nymph ticks, right? The nymphal stage can be super tiny, you know, the size of a freckle or a poppy seed. So they're easy to miss. And so if you missed it on your tick check at night, if you check in the morning, you may actually, you know, especially if that tick's been feeding on you, it's going to be larger. And so you're more likely to detect it. the other thing too is that if you're like me and you have pets that sleep with you, well, you know, if a tick comes in on a pet and then your pet sleeps with you and then overnight the tick decides to abandon ship and crawl onto you, you know, you wouldn't have caught it the night before, but you sure will in the morning.
Exactly. What do you hope readers will come away with after reading your book, Lyme, Ticks, and You?
I think kind of three main things. One is that I hope they just get the kind of the basic science of Lyme disease and tick-borne illnesses, so that they know how to protect themselves, but also that they know how to advocate for themselves. Because as we know, you know, our medical system is not particularly friendly towards those of us, especially with chronic Lyme. And so you absolutely need to know the basics of Lyme to advocate for yourself. You know, I want people to adopt these measures to protect themselves from tick bites, to try to minimize it so that they can get outside and enjoy them. You know, I want to make them aware of kind of like just sort of the truth of Lyme, you know, not the stuff that unfortunately that we're getting from public health and from our doctors. And I don't say that with any, you know, malicious intent. It's just that, you know, the information that they're often sharing is so outdated. And, you know, so I really did strive to put, you know, the most recent science in this book so that people can understand it and you know, have information in there about, you know, how to get help, how to get a diagnosis, you know, where to turn to. And I think the other part of it, although it's not a huge focus of the book, part of the reason why I started off with my own personal story is I do want people to understand that even though we live in a country with a universal healthcare system, we don't. And that those of us with chronic Lyme are sadly, you know, actively discriminated against in terms of treatment. I mean, I've spent close to $30,000 out of pocket in under 2 years for diagnosis and treatment, and I've just basically killed my retirement, you know, and it's frustrating. And I think, as I say, you know, I don't sort of share any of that with any malicious intent. It's just that it is the truth. And I think people need to know about it because I think we need, you know, there's a lot of wonderful people who have been advocating for Lyme patients for many years and have made great inroads. But I think it's time now that the general public understand what's going on and to help us advocate for change in a positive and collaborative way.
Oh, that's so great. Well, I want to just thank you so much for your time and your expertise, and mostly thank you for doing all the research and putting it into this fabulous book. We will post a link on our website and people can go there to learn more and get the scientific background. And I just think the more perspectives we have trying to solve this problem, the quicker we get to a solution.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree more. And I think, you know, we really need to work collaboratively with the medical community and the research community to move things forward. And I'm hopeful that we will get there. I mean, it's been a hard slog so far, but, you know, I really hope that, you know, we can continue to raise more awareness about Lyme disease and other tick-borne illnesses. It's not just Lyme, right? You know, sadly, a lot of us know that, you know, the impacts of having other tick-borne illnesses that the ticks around me carry, such as, you know, Babesia and Bartonella and those sorts of things. So, you know, I really hope that we can educate the public, but also, you know, really get them on board to help us to advocate with our medical profession in Canada so that we move forward in a positive way.
Great advice. Well, we will get there. We'll keep pushing forward.
You bet.
Thank you for your time.
Thanks so much, Sarah. It's great to meet you.
I was fascinated to hear that the University of Guelph has been doing surveillance in Eastern Ontario, and the majority of ticks they sampled tested positive for Lyme. With leadership, medical collaboration, and research from scientists like Dr. Shelley Ball, we are moving forward to a solution. This is our final podcast for Season 2. Have a fabulous summer playing outside, and just remember, stay safe.
Dream a despite, 'cause baby. Sometimes two people fall out of love, 'cause one of them can't stop thinking of girls who really know how to. You be the judge.
I'm Dr. Anthony Leizowitz, and this is Climate Connections.
When you find uncooked food lurking in your fridge, you might throw it out if the date on the package has passed. But perhaps you shouldn't.
There's been a lot of confusion about how to interpret these labels. Like, we call them expiration dates, but they're actually not necessarily expiration dates.
Anjali Narang is a PhD candidate at Cornell University. She says the date does not always indicate food safety. Sometimes it indicates when a product's quality is best. But knowing what's meant is often confusing, because the wording on food labels varies.
There's used by, best of used by, best before, sell by, fresh by, I've even seen just the date.
Narang was part of a team that studied how the wording on these labels affects food waste, which is bad for the climate and consumers' wallets. She found that people were more likely to trash food if the label only had a date on it, or if the label included the word use in any form. For example, best if used by, or simply use by.
So our theory is that people are interpreting these dates as expiration dates,
even if that's not what's meant. So the study indicates that standardizing food labels could help reduce food waste. But the wording chosen must be clear to consumers.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To hear more stories like this, visit climateconnections.org.
But the wording chosen must be clear to consumers.
We'll be right back. The Nikkei Garden Farmers Market is pleased to announce its return for the third year in a row, running from June to October. The market will take place on the second and fourth Sundays of each month from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. Visitors to the market can enjoy a relaxing stroll through the locally grown produce booths, indulge in the delicious locally crafted food, and explore unique artisanal goods made by local makers, while taking in the seasonal beauty of the Japanese garden. To learn more about this event, visit center.nikkeiplace.org.
Wandering Rhythms, Mondays from noon to 2.
Join us in a weekly sample of music from planet Earth.
The strangest mixtape you will ever hear.
Desert blues.
Balkan punk.
Latin funk.
African psych.
Pigeon rap.
And anything and everything else you can imagine, equally represented by all continents.
Because good music is universal.
Wandering Rhythms.
Mondays at noon on CJSF 90.1 FM.
Roger, roll, Atlantis.
Houston now controlling the flight of Atlantis. The space shuttle spreads its wings one final time for the start of a sentimental journey into history.
Will I never be to Disneyland?
Affirmative.
That was definitely an e-ticket.
Roger that, Sally.
Set your alarm clocks to Jen LaFranc on Wednesdays from 6 to 8 a.m. for On the Tracks. I'll bring you the best new music in roots Americana,
rock,
R&B, and soul right here on CJSF 90.1 FM in Burnaby, British Columbia.